I think we're really on another edge, another precipice in terms of teaching and learning and technology and innovation. And I think there's some collisions occurring in this time frame. And I say that I think we're on another edge because in my career, I've gone kind of deep into technology and teaching and learning. And when I get frustrated with either the technology or the administration or the faculty or myself or the students or whatever, then I go back to furniture design and furniture construction. And a couple of years ago, I was about ready to go back. But I've been re-energized by some of the changes and some of the movement in terms of what technology can do. But we have to be careful on how we interleave the innovations in teaching and learning and the innovations with technology. And Gardner's going to help us kind of think about that from the perspective of what is the faculty role? And I think that's one of the big questions we have right now. If we try to push more of the learning, the activities that students are doing into a technology world, what do we do as faculty in that limited but important time that we are with students face-to-face? And that's the piece that I think is the challenge and the excitement right now. So I'd like to introduce Gardner Campbell. He's a friend. I don't know when we first met, but we've known each other off and on for a while. We have a lot of common colleagues in this world of teaching and learning and technology. Right now, Gardner is a professor of English, I believe, at Virginia Commonwealth University. He was the dean of their university college, a vice provost for learning innovation. He's been doing this kind of work for a long time. I suspect when he gets frustrated with it, he goes back to Milton, and that's probably where he spends his solace time. So I'd like to introduce Gardner and take it away.
So I think this lavalier is working. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep, good. I'd like to thank you for the naming opportunity of the auditorium. I really appreciate that. And now I feel very affirmed because when I was at the University of Illinois to give a talk several years ago, I did it in Alice Hall, and Alice is the name of my wife, and I was very happy to report that to her, but for years now I've thought there's got to be a Gardner somewhere. Today I found it complete with an observation deck where people can keep an eye on Gardner if they need to, which is pretty much a done deal. So anyway, thank you very much for the invitation to be here today. It's what a beautiful campus. I've never been here before, and just walking along this morning and measuring with footsteps the distance between Drury and the South Campus at a little over 7,000 feet in elevation. Virginia is kind of a sea level deal in Richmond, so this is different. But aside from the beneficial, arduous cardiovascular events, I just, you know, everywhere I looked, you're one of the few places where the kind of advertisements on the poles actually go onto what looks like a view straight into heaven. I mean, it really is kind of astonishing. So I'm sure you don't take it for granted. I don't think I would ever get used to how pretty it is here. So that was a treat I didn't anticipate. So thank you for that. And it's a great honor to be afforded the opportunity to be the keynote speaker for this year's Southwest Symposium on Teaching and Learning. Long may you run. So I'm not a politician. I'm just an English professor with classes starting up next week and some syllabi I need to finish. Maybe some of you know the feeling. But I want to begin my talk with just a few words about the terrible events last weekend in Charlottesville. As I see the pictures of the white supremacist merchants of hate with their torches and their insignia, standing in a mob in front of the rotunda of the University of Virginia, which is a school that I love. It's a school where my daughter, my wife, and I have earned a total of 4 degrees between us. I feel that higher education itself is under attack. Higher education at its best encourages tolerance, reasoned debate, and deep, effective collaboration toward the betterment of society. We don't always live up to those ideals. Thomas Jefferson did not live up to his ideals either. But these are ideals worth aspiring to, ideals worth living by. And on Saturday, 3 Americans died defending those ideals. So I'd ask if you would please share a moment of silence with me now to honor their memory and their sacrifice. Thank you. So, I gave you some grammar to play with before today, because English professor. The role of university faculty, yes, I forgot the university in the title slide, but it's back. The role of university faculty in an age of ubiquitous personal networked computing. And because English professor, I said, well, there are four nouns and there are four adjectives, and that kind of pleased me. And I figure somebody must have said university, Dr. Campbell, is a noun. And it's true, it is a noun. And frankly, I will be talking about it as a noun today. So, okay. However, in the sentence, it is in fact an adjective. So I just want to put that out there for you. I have this imposter syndrome problem. I figure if I don't have the parts of speech right, they're going to yank my certificate. So it could happen, right? You ever have those anxiety dreams? Somebody knocks on the door and says, "Hi, we don't. We've examined the records. We don't know how you got out, but we'll have that diploma. Thank you." Not only then will we do parts of speech, but I also have an urge to recombine these adjectives and nouns a little bit. This is a really nice sentence, but the words don't come in quite the right order. Maybe in a Romance language, this would all be a lot simpler. I don't know, but I'm going to scramble it a little bit and talk about these things, these adjectives, these ideas, the values underneath them, I think, in this order. I want to start with faculty. That should please every faculty member in the room. However, that means you're on the hook for everything that follows. Okay, so that's the reward for going first. Then university. What is this university that modifies faculty? Most faculty would say, no university will ever modify me. But I digress. What is the role of a faculty member in a university in this age? What age is this? This is the age of computing. Computing that is personal, that is ubiquitous, that is networked. And these are different things. I reserve the right to scramble these words even a little bit more as we go along, because they interact in complex ways. I could have written many other talks with these words in different orders, but I think this will give us a framework at least to develop some better questions. I'm not going to have any answers for you today. The only takeaways you'll have are some ideas and probably some points to disagree with, but I think that's okay. Ideas and points to disagree with kind of sounds like a faculty to me. So let's get started. Let's get started with Google. How many of you know the etymology trick with Google? How many of you have done that before? Okay, good. Got some etymology fans in the room. It used to be that Google would reward you for going to find space word, but then upping the ante, as Google can do, Google will now give you the etymology, the derivation, something of the history of the word. When you just put in that search bar, etymology space word, it'll even give you a distribution over time of the frequency of use of that word, so that you can get some idea, when did Shangri-La start to be a thing and El Dorado stopped being a thing? When did that happen? You kind of see the lines crossing a bit. So I typed in etymology faculty. And it turns out it's from Latin. Okay, that's nice. And it means to make or do, and it also has this sense of ease in it. Other words related to that are fact, factory, facility, etc. All these words coming from this really very stark action, make or do. So what is it that faculty make or do with such ease? What is it that faculty possess as a particular facility within the environment of the university? Well, if you click on the little down arrow, you start to get some results. Turns out, all faculty will love this, of course. It's an inherent mental or physical power. As we say in Latin, quod erat demonstrandum. There you go. So, her critical faculties. Or an aptitude or talent for doing something. The author's faculty for philosophical analysis. That's pretty good. Then we get into what we see in a university. The teaching staff of a university or a college or of one of its departments or divisions viewed as a body. Sadly, this use case here is, we're making some progress, but it's still not enough. There were no tenured women on the faculty. And especially in Canada, where they don't have schools or colleges of this or that, it can mean a group of university departments concerned with a major division of knowledge. So the Faculty of Arts and Sciences means the School of Arts and Sciences, not just the faculty in that unit or that division. And then intriguingly, it's a license or authorization, especially from a church authority. That is to say, some higher power gives faculty authorization to make or do something with ease in a university. Well, what is that higher power? It may or may not be a church authority, but there is, I think, an ideal or something that happens that's greater than the sum of its parts, greater than the semester's worth of content, greater even than many years of unhappiness in graduate school with a PhD at the end. Something bigger than all of who and what we are that makes this making or doing happen. It facilitates learning. And it results in somebody who's good at being learned. Okay, so it's in a university. Why is it in a university? Faculty don't have to be in a university, but if they are, it's interesting to see that university, in its original meaning, back to the Latin again, comes from the Latin universitas magistrorum et scholarium, which roughly means community of teachers and scholars. I like that. It keeps the focus on the people who are making or doing, who are learned, who are working together to advance this knowledge. However, a little later in this article, in modern usage, the word has come to mean an institution of higher education, offering tuition in mainly non-vocational subjects and typically having the power to confer degrees. And you see the shift there from community to institution, from teachers and scholars working together on the big project of becoming learned in a way that allows you to make or do something with ideas, with bricks, with steel, with whatever. Instead, the shift is to, frankly, where they're keeping your payroll on time. That's an important thing. I'm glad for institutions to do that. However, when students come to university, they don't come to the buildings. They don't come to the institution. They believe they're doing that. I understand the shorthand, but I want to suggest that the role of these learned people within a university has something to do with the idea of community, a community of teachers and scholars. So that's a university. It may be in a building that belongs to the Sorbonne, but it's a university. That's the community of teachers and scholars. That's the university. And the university has had a tremendous amount of success in the modern era, and also what we might identify as some characteristic pathologies, some of which are because of the move from community to institution. Not all bad. The successes can be pretty astounding. Clark Kerr in The Uses of the University, which is an amazing book. If you haven't taken a look at it, I warmly recommend it to you. He was Chancellor of the University of California at Berkeley. In the 1960s, he was pretty much pushed out toward the end of the 60s, but then went to work for the Carnegie Foundation, and every 10 years he'd write another chapter about the state of higher education in the United States. And when Kerr thought about what these institutions had empowered, he came up with some really great triumphs. Because of this community of teachers and scholars together in an institutional setting, amplifying the power of their community, because of that, we're closer to the goal of universal access to higher education. Not there, but a lot closer than we were. Research universities are the place driving discovery and innovation, not industry. Industry's fine, but within the setting of a nonprofit community of teachers and scholars working together on this vast project of learning, of discovering, creating, sharing, conserving knowledge. That has been something that's kept the focus on community and public good to a larger extent than it might have if that focus, if those federal dollars had gone straight to industry. And it's undeniable that higher education in the United States and generally has contributed to a rising tide of prosperity and productivity. I have taught at a land-grant university where the heritage coming out of the 1860s when it was established has led to great good in engineering, in agriculture, in the polytechnic infrastructure of the nation. And I like to think that English professors have contributed, if only in Milton studies, to some of that prosperity and productivity too. But there are pathologies as well, many of them also linked to this movement out of community into the institutional setting. Because we get so many dollars from the federal government, there is a very strong federal influence over our intellectual endeavors. So the prospect of becoming learned and pursuing truth wherever it may lead gets driven also by pursuing truth wherever it may lead while we seek the renewal of the grant from the granting agency for the next 2 years with this percentage, et cetera, et cetera. You know how that goes. So the sayings follow the money, and many times the intellectual endeavors will do that. And that means, talking about Miltonists again, the sciences have received far and away the lion's share of federal spending as this discovery and innovation is funded by the government. Those inequities in funding, which will only be exacerbated if the National Endowment for the Humanities falls under the Budget Acts, which I hope it doesn't, makes a difference in the culture of the university. It makes a difference in the culture of the community. Now there are two cultures, as C.P. Snow famously pointed out. And that can make for, as I'm sure many of you recognized, a great deal of hostility and distrust, and even spawn different languages from one end of campus to the other. And of course, our massive research universities have ended up valuing research and service over teaching, with particular neglect of undergraduates, except insofar as their tuition dollars will support the rest of the activities in the university. And then this is one that all faculty love to hate, but that's okay. The dark side is open to everyone. A new class of faculty and administrators chasing dollars and neglecting educational policy issues. And part of what I want to try to emphasize today is that not all of this is done for despicable reasons or because people are just evil in their hearts and, you know, they can't imagine this idea of community that I keep talking about. A lot of it happens because the questions get very simplified, they get narrowed, they get very focused, and we don't have the ideas or the ideals in our minds as we try to do the next operational thing. It's always a challenge to get from the operational to the strategic to the mission. Always a challenge. And yet when we don't keep the mission and the ideals in mind, some regrettable consequences can emerge. So let me suggest that in this photograph, we see something of the role of university faculty in miniature. It's, of course, a commencement ceremony in which faculty in their robes, they don't have capes or insignia on their chest, but they do have within their own lives of expertise and devotion to knowledge a certain authority to be able to hand a diploma to someone who is graduating. Now, this is not what we think of as an institution granting degrees. This is a community of scholars and teachers acknowledging that another scholar has emerged and has attained a certain level of proficiency and can now be a fuller member of that community of scholars and teachers. And in my view, it is entirely just and right that some kind of exchange occurs, in this case, a diploma, from which our words for diplomacy, diplomat, I mean, it's a folded piece of paper in its etymology that certifies something, but it's more than that, it's a credential. It enables a person's credibility. And it's entirely good and right that there is some formal acknowledgement of that, with robes that indicate, if not a divine higher power, something that is greater than the sum of its parts, and not just people doing work for a paycheck, though I will emphasize the paycheck is important. So, this community of people who are good at being learned, at putting together courses of study, ideally, that represent the state of knowledge insofar as we imagine it to be communicated and co-created by students as they pass through the 4 years of a traditional education, that moment that happens, that diploma, that's one of the big roles, and a role that stands for, I think, all the other roles of faculty in a university. And it's interesting to see, again, diploma, who knew? It actually has a couple of senses. This is most of the institutional sense, a certificate or deed issued by an educational institution, such as college or university, that testifies that the recipient has successfully completed a particular course of study. This is a great thing. It's also what you can buy online and put your, there is actually a diploma of your name here. And if you Google that, you can purchase it and have it delivered to you. I think you can put it on two-day shipping. So this is okay, but it's not enough. This is more interesting. And it gets back to this idea of community. The diploma as a document certifying a qualification may also be called a testimor, Latin for we testify or certify. So, the role of faculty in a university is to become a community of teachers and scholars, united in their authority, willingness, openness to be able to testify to the accomplishments, the learning, the preparedness, the diligence, the persistence of those who have been in their company for however many years the degree program has lasted. When those faculty are up on that stage with the student, it's all sages on the stage at that point, and a good thing too. There is a testimony that is occurring, not at the institutional level, but it's the community itself witnessing to something that has happened and a level of achievement that the student has accomplished. So now that we have that settled, I know that doesn't settle very many things, it gives us something to think about, perhaps, especially as we finish our syllabi for next week. When do classes start here? Is it next week?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. Oh,
you've got lots of time.
Get to your syllabi next week. Don't worry. That's me for the flight home, right? As we think about those things, we have to think about the fact that this community that I'm describing, this testimony that I'm talking about, takes place in a context, and not just a geographical context. It takes place in a chronological context. And this is where I want to move to that intersection or that collision that Don spoke of in the introduction. Faculty roles in a university must respond to the age we live in. And the age we live in is an age of computing. And it's not very old, 70 years maybe, depending on how you count. If you count it back to some of the fundamental papers that were written, it might go back to the 1930s or so, but it doesn't go much farther back than that. Take it even back as far as Ada Lovelace and Charles Babbage. We're still not even at the two-century mark. And it is this particular age we live in where that idea and experience of computing becomes available to many of us, most of us, and more of us as time goes on. How many of you have read As We May Think? Anybody know that essay, Vannevar Bush? I recommend it to you very, very highly. Vannevar Bush was FDR's science advisor, head of the Manhattan Project, and in 1945 he publishes an essay in the Atlantic Monthly saying, look, we've just come together, the finest minds in the United States, to devise the deadliest device we've ever devised, the atomic bomb. What can we do in peacetime that might be as rewarding and a lot more constructive with these minds, with this energy? And as we may think, he essentially imagines something of our computing future. And he's talking about vacuum tubes when he talks about this. He had no idea about the transistor age. That really was a tipping point. But he did observe that the industrial age had led us to an age of cheap, complex devices of great reliability, and something is bound to come of it. Well, something did come of it. Because we have cheap, complex devices of great reliability, we have an infrastructure of computing that more or less we can and do depend on. Part of this is because of Moore's law, which, depending on which source you read, is something like this. Every 18 months, computers double in power, and the price is cut in half. Now, you'll see that there are many people who say we're just about at the end of Moore's law. We can't cram any more transistors onto the chips. We're going to run into all sorts of tunneling effects. It's not going to work. But we've got quantum computing, 3D chips to work with. I don't think we've seen the end of Moore's law quite yet. But that kind of development, just between 1971 and 2011, has been exponential. It's why we have the computing power available to us today that we do. This, too, is an accelerator of this age that I'm describing. And it leads to what Clay Shirky, in 2008, I think accurately characterized as the largest increase in expressive capability in the history of the human race. And it's happened over not quite a century. Really, it's happened over about 50 years. That much of an increase at that unprecedented scale, at that unprecedented rate, is highly disruptive. It's terrifying in many respects. It also should be catnip for everyone working in teaching and learning. Because expressive capability is one of the things that distinguishes us as a species. Shirky observes also in the same book that anytime you change the communicative capacity of human beings, you potentially change almost everything about the world they live in, because that's what we do. We communicate. When language emerged, now we have some way to form concepts. When concepts emerge, we don't have to point at things anymore. We can talk about ideas. And the real breakthrough happened with written language, where we could, for the first time, hear the dead speaking. I don't mean the Grateful Dead. We've heard them too. We can build a civilization out of what our ancestors learned, and we don't have to start from scratch. So, the phonetic alphabet, major increase in expressive capability. I think it's the only one in human history we can point to as being on the level of the increase in expressive capability that we're looking at right now. I am aware that this is at least a million-edged sword. As far as I know, hate speech depends upon the same alphabet that we use to write ringing declarations of academic freedom. It's the same alphabet. And if you think that print technology is better than what we see online, take a look at an airline magazine. Nah, not so much. Although SkyMall is fun, I will admit. But this is an interesting moment to be alive. It is an interesting set of problems and opportunities to face, especially in teaching and learning. What should we do with this massive increase in expressive capability? What things will build us up and not tear us apart? And I can tell you, it doesn't happen when you outlaw laptops in the classroom or tell people to put their smartphones away. There may be times to do that, but when there's an increase in expressive capability, that's the tiger you want to grab by the tail. That's the place you want to be as an educator. It's a difficult and awkward place to be, but if you could have figured out that Shakespeare would be the premier writer in English, when you could still go see Hamlet in its first run, that would be a good thing. That would be some real prescience. It happened on the wrong side of the Thames. All the prostitutes and pickpockets frequented the Globe, and people wearing, you know, their lords and ladies' finery. You couldn't even tell their social status, and yet that's where Hamlet was. That's where you would need to be. So these massive increases in expressive capability didn't always happen in very highly regulated and decorous ways. Human beings have wild streaks in them, but that's okay. We figured out how to use the alphabet. We figured out how to use the printing press. Maybe we can figure out how to use this digital medium as well, because it has certain peculiar properties that are quite interesting. So now I come to the next word, which is computing. George Dyson in Turing's Cathedral writes very bold words: the stored program computer, as conceived by Alan Turing and delivered by John von Neumann, broke the distinction between numbers that mean things and numbers that do things. Our universe would never be the same. Now, I'm an English professor. I don't understand all the math, but the idea, I think I can get my head around part of it. It's a long-standing human ambition that something connected with our mentalities could actually matter in terms of work we do in the world. That there won't be this mind-body split. That concepts can somehow act upon material reality in ways that would look like magic in many civilizations. In fact, originally, it was conceived of as a kind of magic. This is Orpheus, who was, in Greek mythology, the greatest poet of all. And he would sing his poems to the lyre, and his poems were written in what they called numbers, because there was a real affinity between poetry, mathematics, and music. And Orpheus, if you know the myth, was able to make rocks weep. He was able to make things in the material world respond to the art he created. He wasn't able to cheat death, but that was because of a lack of faith. Which, again, a lack of faith, a lack of nerve, don't look back, keep moving forward. So the tale of Orpheus and Eurydice did not turn out as well as it might have. But the ambition is deeply rooted in our humanity, that something of the things we think about really will lead to that making and that doing that we saw in the earlier definition of faculty. So computing, where the world is rendered and given back to us as bits, where we're able to make mathematics be a television show, or steer a 3D printer, or whatever. This is a long-standing human ambition, and we're in the age where it's happening. In this age, computers are becoming ubiquitous. In what a colleague of mine used to call the great ubiquitous computing scare of 2000, we were trying to put computers on every desktop. We thought ubiquitous computing would mean that everyone would be able to go to a computer. Maybe some of the really bold prophets thought we might carry laptops around with us. But who knew? 88% of US adults use the internet. 77% now have broadband at home. And the real steep climb has been in that little thing that's recording me up there right now, the smartphone. The smartphone is ubiquitous computing. As you all know, as the signs even indicate, the student should put them away. I was walking down the drive and it said, "What's around you is more beautiful than your news feed. Pay attention to your surroundings." Okay, that's true. Depending on the day, it was kind of dark yesterday at one point. The news feed while I was inside was better than the storm outside, but that's okay. Most of the time, that's true. Nevertheless, ubiquitous computing means that this astonishing Orpheus-like ability is available to everyone in their pockets pretty much all the time. That's the other part of ubiquity, maybe the one that we didn't anticipate. The smartphone was not only mobile computing in a new form. Part of its power results from the fact that if you have a data plan, it's connected to the internet all the time. And because it is ubiquitously connected, all these network effects that I'll explore in a moment become much, much more powerful. So what about this personal thing? We all know about personal computing, but the smartphone really raises the ante. And this is interesting from an educational point of view, as Jerome Bruner wrote, not about smartphones, but about intimacy, many years ago. Bruner writes, "Man's working image of himself is anchored in his sense of intimacy, in the events and relations that are the fabric of his immediate experience and make up his way of life. Change in the individual is a function of how much and in what manner an intimate way of life is altered." Any of you who depend on your smartphone for your contacts and maybe even your own phone number, I'm sorry, maybe I'm projecting, will understand that there is something unusually intimate about the personal computer that we carry with us. It really does start to feel like an extension of ourselves. That's not always good, but it is a tremendous opportunity, and I think a lesson for us in teaching and learning with technology, that brute force scaling of technology is not as effective a way to be able to get at the change that education should foster in our students. Better to find some way for that technology to be intimate, that technology to matter to their way of life. I, unfortunately, am old enough now to remember many, many iterations ago in an LMS company, whose name I will not utter, when I was talking about discussion forums, and I had just happened on PHP BB as an absolutely free, open source discussion forum. I could run it on my own server that I rented for $10 a month from Bluehost. This was amazing. It was liberatory. Why? Because my students could have avatars, small graphical representations of themselves. And the LMS vendor said, "Why would you want that?" In other words, what difference would it make if students could actually artfully make some representation of themselves in a discussion forum? Well, aside from the intimacy Bruner's talking about, I can't think of any reason. For the LMS vendor, it was about simply an exchange of information. It was completely transactional. And, you know, bless his heart, as we say in Virginia, probably he couldn't imagine any other way. But I will tell you that when I used that discussion forum in my film class, not only did participation double from what it had been in the LMS, but my students surprised me in two ways. First of all, a student wrote me on the first day of class and said, "Really glad to see this forum. Could you put the Solaris theme up?" And I said, "Sure." I had no idea what he's talking about, but I figured Google would know. So I just Googled, you know, something like Solaris theme PHP BB. And because people like to do little tutorials for each other, I very quickly found out how to put the Solaris theme in there. And then I stopped and I thought, now wait a minute. A student has just asked me to collaborate with him on helping to design a learning environment that he would find expressive of himself and more of an intimate experience. That's not too shabby. I'll take that. And then the avatars. Boy, did they have fun with avatars. In fact, they showed me that you could put animated GIFs in as avatars. So one of my film students had a little GIF. It was the eeriest, to this day, it's still the eeriest GIF I've ever seen. It was James Dean, the late James Dean, the late great James Dean, looking straight ahead and then suddenly casting his glance to the side. I'm still not sure exactly how she did it, but every time I saw her in the forum, I was like, ooh, that's really eerie. What are the learning gains for that? Suddenly, she had an intimate experience of a teaching and learning technology in a way that was expressive of herself, her own creativity. Oh, and it was film studies, so James Dean was perfectly aligned with what we were doing, and so forth. This stuff matters. It's easy to say that it doesn't, and I think it's a mistake when we think about technology and how it can empower individuals to be part of a community of intimate transformation. Now let's network them. Network effects are weird things. This is Metcalfe's law, which asserts that the value of a telecommunications network is proportional to the square of the number of connected users of the system. In other words, every next user has an exponential part to play in the power of the network, because each new node makes the complexity of the possible connections on the network far greater. Now, this is not an idea that's intuitively obvious, I don't think. It looks like you're just kind of out there with a million people all tapping at stuff on your smartphone. But it's the network effects that empower, again, what Clay Shirky has pointed out as a unique property of this computing environment. For the first time, we don't have simply one-to-many or many-to-one. We have many-to-many connections. And you see this everywhere. The Twitter hashtag is probably the most familiar ad hoc group organizing communication signal that you know of today. It's extraordinarily powerful. It signals in multiple ways, and it works as it does because of these network effects. It's as powerful as it is because it's many to many. There's even a fellow named Reed who's added his bit to Metcalf. He says even Metcalf's law doesn't get to it. If you look at networks as not only many to many, but also as group forming, then you, if you have your network together, you can look at a certain number of groups that can be formed within that network. And that increases exponentially. You have, within this network effect, within these series of possible interconnections, something truly extraordinary that can nevertheless be mobilized, that can actually be used. Which reminds me, I don't know what the hashtag is for your conference today. Does it have a hashtag? Let's make one up. Southwest Teaching Symposium, SWTS 17. Does that work?
Yep.
Okay, that's it. Now go change the world. Okay, hashtag SWTS, Teaching and Learning Symposium, right? Okay, SWTLS 17. If you use the other one, that's okay, just delete it and go back. SWTLS 17. What?
Twitter.
What? Sorry, say it again.
I said I don't think I follow you.
Oh, you don't follow me?
That's Twitter humor.
Oh. That's pretty good. You don't have to follow me, just follow a hashtag. I am but a lowly keynote speaker. The hashtag, it's like the force. It surrounds us, it bonds us. May the hashtag be with you. So you put these together, you get exponents plus exponents, you get what John Seely Brown calls hyper-exponential forces at work. Because they're not independent laws, they interact with each other. And because they rule our technological infrastructure, they enable powerful changes in the way we live, work, and learn, which is kind of overwhelming. But think about it another way. Really, what this is your brain on brain. These technologies are mind-like. They're the first ones that have been mind-like in exactly this way. What you're looking at still doesn't add up to the number of connections among the neurons possible in your brain. But you are looking at something that is, I would almost say, a kind of a personality made of everyone in it interacting. I'm not talking about Skynet, but I am talking about the emergence of a new form of shared consciousness, unruly, unpredictable, and yet potentially, and aren't we in the potential business, potentially something that could create something quite extraordinary. And the early architects of the digital age wanted that future. They aimed at that future. So I want to conclude with some of the most aspirational statements that I know of having to do with this technological, digital, computing world that we live in an age of ubiquitous, personal, networked computing. The people who put this together had an idea at the end of the Moore's Law explosion how this might play out. One of them was J.C.R. Licklider, who was one of the first directors of ARPA and really was, in many respects, the father of the ARPANET. And brought a number of very talented people together to try to figure out these technological breakthroughs we would need. But always, because he was a psychologist, what he had in mind was how will this empower human beings. And in a great little book called Computers in the World of the Future, which is usually put in the business section of the library because it was the proceedings of a business conference in 1962. Licklider wrote, "No one knows what it would do to a creative brain to think creatively continuously. Perhaps the brain, like the heart, must devote most of its time to rest between beats. But I doubt that this is true. I hope it is not, because interactive computers can give us our first look at unfettered thought. Not necessarily undisciplined thought, not necessarily random thought, although I tell my students the human brain can't do random. It's a true story, you can look that up. But unfettered, that is, not limited by boundaries of space or time or ethnicity or class, not bound by all of those barriers that get in the way of community. Maybe we can see that. Sometimes we can see it, I think, in the world we live in." Someone funded by J.C.R. Licklider, a fellow named Doug Engelbart, who designed the mouse, word processing, various kinds of outlining techniques, video conferencing, rudimentary wikis, rudimentary geolocation, really an astonishing visionary, used that funding to create what was finally called the mother of all demos, December 9, 1968, where all of that was demonstrated at a joint computer conference. He had a way of talking about what he called the integrated domain, a kind of human-computer symbiosis that would, in his words, augment human intellect. And in the same year, 1962, before he'd been funded, while he was still working away at a study on how to enhance human effectiveness, he wrote these very stirring words. "We do not speak of isolated clever tricks that help in particular situations. We refer to a way of life in an integrated domain where hunches, cut and try, intangibles, and the human feel for a situation usefully coexist with powerful concepts, streamlined terminology and notation, sophisticated methods, and high-powered electronic aids." This is still back in the batch processing and punch card days, but because of these aspirations, because Engelbart had this intuition that these machines might actually be able to enhance human effectiveness and augment human intellect, he provided a vision for what life in that integrated domain might be like. I think higher education is one of the key places where people learn to create and live productively with full civic responsibility within this integrated domain. It's what we do as human beings. Bob Taylor, who later went on to be highly influential at Xerox's Palo Alto Research Center, which gave us essentially early versions of personal computing. He was someone who had that dream too. In a book called The Dream Machine, Mitch Waldrop writes that the real significance of computing was to be found not in this gadget or that gadget, but in how the technology was woven into the fabric of human life, how computers could change the way people thought, the way they created, the way they communicated, the way they worked together, the way they organized themselves, even the way they apportioned power and responsibility. That was what had resonated so deeply in Taylor's mind. And this wasn't so long ago. In fact, Doug Engelbart passed away just 4 years ago. Bob Taylor passed away just earlier this year. This fellow is still alive. I've had the privilege of speaking with him on several occasions. And this is my favorite saying about this age of computing we live in. The computer is an instrument whose music is ideas. Not a content delivery medium, not a drill and kill, but an instrument whose music is ideas. Our students, our community of teachers and scholars need to be able to make this music together. Another one of those radicals you hear so much about, a fellow named Ted Nelson, put out a self-published book called Computer Lib, Dream Machines, in 1974, and he had this to say, again, very prescient. "Education ought to teach and reward initiative, curiosity, the habit of self-motivation, intellectual involvement. Educators and computer enthusiasts tend to agree on these goals, but what happens? many of the inhumanities of the existing system, some of those pathologies Kerr talked about, no less wrong for being unintentional, are being continued into computer-assisted teaching. This is something to think about, something that Alan Kay has said some very interesting things about. He was at a National Institute for Technology and Liberal Education conference just 5 years ago, and this is what he had to say about the way computers and education often don't align very well.
Because people only value these things the way they value their TV sets. Not a question about whether they can afford it or not, it's a question of value. People have multiple cars, et cetera, et cetera. They know what a car is good for. They have no idea what they're... This thing is just a convenient way of dealing with stuff they're already familiar with. Most people never do anything remotely like what I was showing you today on the computer. They just use it for the fact that it can represent descriptions of anything. Right? So in fact, we are actually in a more dangerous condition now than we were 30 years ago. It's exactly the opposite, in my opinion. And the reason is that the reason stated that, for instance, these things are being sold in many places, particularly iPads, are being sold as textbooks replacement. We don't want to replace textbooks. They suck. I was showing you a textbook. Textbook of the future is something where you're not shown something, you're given advice on how to create a model for yourself of this knowledge. So we couldn't be in worse shape now.
So where does that leave us? The choices we make with the teaching and learning technologies that we choose contain within them ideas about the roles of faculty in a university, also about what we believe learners to be. And Jerome Bruner has put this very well, and this is what I'll end on. In a great little article called Folk Pedagogy, in a book called The Culture of Education, Bruner writes, "Any choice of pedagogical practice, including those enhanced by digital technologies, implies a conception of the learner and may in time be adopted by him or her as the appropriate way of thinking about the learning process. For a choice of pedagogy inevitably communicates a conception of the learning process and the learner. Pedagogy is never innocent. It is a medium that carries its own message." So what I would ask is, what idea of learning do we want to communicate in our pedagogies? And what idea of learning and what learning should look like is communicated by our technological choices? In the context of the aspirations of the founders of the digital age, in the context of this very interesting moment that we're all living in the context of a community of teachers and scholars who still, even on bad days in English department meetings, seem to think there's something greater than the sum of our parts, something higher than just what we're doing as individuals. What are we going to choose to do to convey to our learners that we want them, as you're engraved in stone, says on my way here today, to become educated in order to become more human? As the age goes on, the questions will get more complex. It might be useful to return to some of the ideas behind the questions. Thank you for your attention, and I hope that the rest of the day goes well for you.